This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. The Baltic states, formerly under the boot of the Soviet Empire, now independent members of NATO, members of the EU, a prosperous land, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. I learn, however, from Patrick Tucker, the technology editor of Defense One, that Estonia is under assault. How? Carjacking, harassment by Russian speakers. Why? Patrick, a very good evening to you. I lack a larcenous brain. It never would have occurred to me that at the KGB / FSB, there was a carjacking division. What is going on to your understanding in Estonia? Good evening to you.
Good evening. Yes, a very interesting alert put out yesterday by Estonia's Internal Security Service Director, reiterated by the Prime Minister on X, which is formerly Twitter, basically alerting to what they're calling a Kremlin-backed hybrid warfare operation in Estonia, where GRU officials, so part of the Russian military, use social media to reach out to Russian-speaking citizens in Estonia, and there were some that apparently had Russian passports too, paid them money to vandalize the car of the interior minister and a couple of journalists. And it's all part of this effort to create a sense in Estonia that popular sentiment is rising against the government, against the West, against their support for Ukraine. It's basically trying to sow ethnic divisiveness, civil strife. And yet do it through this strange means of finding people in Estonia that identify as ethnically Russian or Russian speaking and pay them money to basically commit mischief. It's fascinating, and it's the sort of thing that sounds pretty quaint when you consider in the context of the active bombing campaign taking place in Ukraine. But this hybrid warfare operation, which is what the government there is calling it, you know, that falls within a pattern of Russian active measures, as they're sometimes called. Those took place in Georgia prior to the Russian invasion of Georgia in 2008. They certainly took place in Ukraine prior to 2014, where the Kremlin was trying to stoke fears, concerns, and ethnic strife in eastern Ukraine, in Donetsk and Luhansk, to convince Russian-speaking people there that the government was out to get them. And now they've turned to Estonia, which has a population of about 22% of Russian speakers, people that identify ethnically as Russian.
Yes, and it's a small population. My memory is it's about 1 million people, extremely well-educated. And I recall some years before the pandemic, an all-digital government. In other words, everything it can be accessed online, very well ahead of us. And in the report from the Security Service Director General, Margot Palasson, I see the Chinese are also involved. Was there any clarity about how China is efforting this for Russia or with Russia? Are they working together?
Well, so this refers to this hybrid warfare technique that China is also adopting primarily in the Pacific. So China also sometimes reaches out to Chinese speakers in places like Singapore, the Philippines, obviously Taiwan, to further this tactic. But really, it was pioneered by the Kremlin, by the Soviet Union. And so you're just going to see like a lot more of this. And to your point, it's natural that Estonia caught it. Estonia has probably the most sophisticated intelligence service in Eastern Europe, probably one of the most sophisticated in the world. If you ever go there, it's like visiting all of Scandinavia except in Eastern Europe, huge technical capabilities in terms of startups, et cetera. So the intelligence service caught this and astute as they are, very quickly informed the world about it, even though it was very small scale. And that's something that, you know, experts say is really important with these hybrid techniques is to identify them and publicize them as quickly as possible, because that protects the population from the effects of these mischief makers that are really just trying to cause civil strife.
There's also a remark by the Prime Minister, and I believe the Prime Minister was threatened on a wanted list by the Kremlin some days past, and probably that was a prep for what you're reporting, that what we're looking at here is all democratic societies, not just Estonia. So Estonia's picked it up, but we believe, or the inference is, that it's going on even in the United States and Mexico. Is that correct, Patrick?
Well, yeah. And I think that you can see that pretty clearly in the Senate Intelligence Committee report from 2018 documenting Russian active measure efforts in the 2016 election. Regardless of who you voted for or why, the Kremlin very definitely did try to steer the electorate towards a particular candidate. If you follow the Black Lives Matter movement, they also tried to support some of the people that were affiliated with those protests, even though the protests had their own organic roots. So it's become very commonplace for Russian information influence operators to glom onto movements in the West in order to kind of pull people apart from one another and cast suspicion on basically central kind of mainstream government officials of both parties. And that's certainly the case in the United States and across administrations. Officials have warned that is a continuing effort from Russia. And it's certainly the case. I think you just can look across Europe and see that influence taking place in elections and campaigns across the board.
Back to the vandalism of the cars. They break windows. They put soap on the window. They throw paint on the front seat. Is that sort of vandalism?
Well, you know, they haven't been too clear yet on exactly what happened. It sounds a little more severe than that. It might have been efforts to light them on fire, because that creates a lot more spectacle. And, right. And you don't go through this effort if you're not about the spectacle. Yes, Estonia is not alone in this. There's also Moldova, which is a very small country, very close to Romania, primarily Ukrainian speaking. But the Institute for the Study of War just last week said that they have become a primary target for Russian hybrid warfare operations. And as we saw in Georgia, Ukraine in 2014 and elsewhere, that might be a pretext for a lot more mischief later this year.
Moldova is especially vulnerable because it's not a member of NATO. It's not even a member of EU. I think it has observation status. It's very small. And it essentially is Odessa province. If you start with Kharkiv and look for Novorossiya, you can stretch it all the way to Odessa province. They're about as vulnerable as you can get on the front line. And you say that, is Estonia reporting that they're struggling with the same instance, or is Moldova reporting?
Well, that comes from the Institute of the Study of War, which basically tracks a lot of open source Russian communications.
I see.
And observes different patterns. And what they've encountered is just Russian officials repeatedly now, with great more urgency and a lot more conviction, trying to highlight the quote-unquote plight of ethnic-speaking Russians in Moldova and create the impression that the central Moldovan government does not care for them and is trying to basically starve them through lack of funds. It's all sort of a nonsense narrative, but it's clearly designed to drive a wedge between those citizens and their government and eventually, potentially, create a pretext for Russian action in that country, military action to protect that native-speaking population, exactly the pretext they employed in Georgia and then in Ukraine.
That's the script from Sudetenland, 1936. That's exact 37, 38, exactly. We need to protect the German speakers in this foreign land. Patrick right. Tucker reporting for Defense One on Estonia's alert and the Institute of Study of War's alert that Russian hybrid attacks include car vandalism. We're going to turn to Russia more threatening still when we come back. Nukes in space. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with my colleague Patrick Tucker, the Defense One technology editor, picking up things way early and very helpful. Right now, Patrick is going to report on something that's in the news, because the administration and members of Congress have accelerated the American public's knowledge of these matters. This is about nuclear weapon in space. The Space Treaty of 1967 forbids the militarization of low Earth orbit, medium Earth orbit, high Earth orbit. However, right now there is a report, and it's repeated from the Biden administration, this is not whispering, that Russia intends or maybe already has deployed a nuclear weapon into low Earth orbit. Why, Patrick? What advantage is there in exploding a nuclear weapon in space?
Yes, thank you. This is something that happened last week. As soon as Representative Congressman Mike Turner from Ohio went to Twitter and said that there was an imminent destabilizing foreign military capability that was a serious national security threat that the White House was sitting on. Naturally, it was only a matter of hours before everyone figured out exactly what he was referring to. And yes, it's this plan on behalf of Russia to launch a nuclear weapon into low Earth orbit, where, if it were to be detonated, would have serious and possibly catastrophic effects on low Earth orbit satellites. So this is something that we know firsthand because the United States in 1962 detonated a 1.4 megaton device about 250 miles above the Pacific Ocean. It was called Starfish Prime. It created a geomagnetic storm that had a terrible effect on the satellites at the time. And thankfully, in 1962, these were not many. But now we are so much more dependent on satellites, and particularly in low Earth orbit, for commercial communication, for just a variety of things, certainly for the military, both imaging of the globe and communication as well. Everything that we have today is so reliant on satellites. There are a handful of satellites that the military uses that are hardened against electromagnetic disruption like that, and they tend to fly at very different orbits, much higher orbits. But make no mistake, while this would be bad for the U.S. military, they could recover from it. It would be pretty catastrophic for civilian life. You would see tremendous disruption almost immediately. Ironically, though, that would probably affect Russia, too. So what you have here is a threat that it's a little bit like the doomsday machine in Dr. Strangelove. If they ever actually lit this thing off, it's not a technological sophisticated device at all. If they were to deploy it, they would be as adversely affected, if not more so. And so what this amounts to is probably another scare tactic, a sort of psychological threat from Vladimir Putin to the world, reminding the world that if you thwart him too much, then you know who knows what they might do. They're a country of tremendous capability, but it's part of a pattern of naming a threat and then backing away from it to gain some sort of concession after he's basically intimidated the world.
The Economist magazine proposed, just immediately after Congressman Turner made the announcement, three possibilities, and I'm wondering if you have any indication which is most likely. One, it's a weapon that can be launched quickly and is not in orbit now. Two, it's in orbit, a nuclear weapon. And three, it's a nuclear-powered device in some fashion that would target other satellites of indeterminate means, maybe with a laser. Is there any indication that it's one of those three?
There was some... not long after these stories broke, there was some indication that it might, in fact, be a nuclear-powered weapon and have a reactor core in it that would still have the job of electromagnetic warfare in space aimed at satellites. And the reason you would have it nuclear-powered is so that it wouldn't the discharge of the weapon wouldn't affect the satellite's ability to collect solar power from the sun. We know this because there are some preliminary sketches of such a device that already exist in open source that Russia may be working on. But there's not a ton of sense of doing that because the primary thing you would use a nuclear-powered spacecraft for is interstellar travel. You just need to be able to continue to go further and further into space, including in spaces where you can't access the sun. Things that are in our orbit, solar collection in space is 10 times more efficient than on Earth. So you can use solar-powered satellites for virtually anything, and it would be a lot less controversial. So if you're going to stick an electromagnetic weapon in space, you would probably just work through the problem of having it be solar-powered because then no one would necessarily know or there wouldn't be any huge controversy about the nuclear power element. So why create something that's less controversial than the thing that it looks like, which is a big nuclear bomb in space? So that alone suggests that it's some sort of nuclear it's an actual nuclear weapon in space, which would have much more effect. In terms of whether it's there now or very soon, the jury is still out on that. The White House has said that it is not something that has been launched yet. But at the same time, 5 days before this announcement, Russia launched a Soyuz 2, 1V rocket with a classified military payload. There's some folks that are speculating that that could be it. So we do not yet know if it's about to be in space or is already in space, but the White House says not yet.
We move from low Earth orbit to the Pacific Ocean because Patrick is reporting the U.S. Navy's thinking about unmanned surface warfare in some fashion. There is a photograph accompanying the article about how the Navy is envisioning hundreds of thousands of drones. These look like, they look like outboards in Hawaii racing between islands. Is this what we're thinking about, these drones that look like a ship with, outboard riggers?
Right. So those are two examples of the Sea Hunter. It's this 100-foot, basically, ghost ship that the Navy has developed. It could potentially carry missiles, or it could not. That is an example of one of the larger drones that they're talking about. But one of the things that Admiral Sam Paparo, the head of U.S. Pacific Fleet, said in giving these remarks last week in San Diego at FCA, is that what you want to do is create a lot of obstacles using a variety of different means. So there's going to be a lot of undersea drones, and the Defense Department has recently contracted with Anduril to develop very kind of medium-sized submarine drones. There's going to be efforts to kind of clog the air with aerial drones that can stay loitering for long periods of time. And, of course, you have big ghost ships like this. So really you want to look at all of the different domains as critical to this plan to, even though he didn't say this explicitly, it's pretty well implied, I think, kind of really crowd out the Taiwan Strait with these capabilities to potentially frustrate Chinese naval maneuvers there, or, if you like, aggressive Chinese maritime actions that they're taking against neighbors like Singapore or like the Philippines.
You end your reporting with a remark that is extremely fetching but hard to interpret. We are in the middle of another epochal change, and that is the dawn, and I do mean the dawn, of the information revolution. What are we looking at here? The robots? Is this back to robot war? We're talking about Terminator thinking? Is that it, Patrick?
Well, it's not just the actual platforms themselves. It's not the actual just things floating in the water and the air. Those are important. What really Paparo here is talking about is the effect of digitized intelligence that is concentrated through AI and then distributed far faster than an adversary can detect, collect, and distribute intelligence to those platforms, to those robots that are in the sea, the sky, and under the surface. He's really talking about the pace of warfare and how information technology, we are beginning to see how it's going to accelerate that pace. But it's really not just through the robots, it's through the information collection capabilities and the processing capabilities, and then the dissemination of that to this wide variety of platforms at once. And as soon as that revolution really begins to take hold, the U.S. military is working very hard to make that the norm now, but they have a very, in many ways, it's kind of a primitive baseline to adapt from. Russia and China are there already in a little bit, but they're much smaller. They don't do joint operations as well. So that is the race that characterizes the next basically two decades, is to not just deploy robots, but to accelerate sensing, sense-making, and distribution of data across a wide number of ships, sailors, drones, satellites, you name it.
Patrick Tucker, Defense One Technology Editor. I'm John Batchelor.